Thank you very kindly. Klaus just gave me this, so I better speak into it. This is a momentous occasion. I've actually been invited back to some place where I've previously spoken, so I take note of that with gratitude. Appreciate that very much. And the speakers that were mentioned who are upcoming are very fine people with very good backgrounds, and I know you will appreciate what they have to share with you both, Professors Flackney and White. Professor White said she's visiting professor. She's my replacement for as long as I'm in administration, because I'm officially a professor of humanity / religion. And even though I continue to teach a course every fall, I don't teach a full slate of courses, and we try to cover for those of us who wind up in administration to make sure that the curriculum is not given short shrift. I've got a number of complicated things I'm going to try to string together, but let me just start by saying something I may or may not have shared with you last year. What was it, about this time last year when we were together, when I was thinking about the dilemma I face at new student orientation when a group of eager, predominantly 18-year-olds are sitting in front of me at the first day of orientation. Their families are there too, so everybody's very nervous, excited, a lot of separation anxiety issues in the air. And it occurred to me some years ago that these 18-year-olds, with respect to the issues that mean the most to us, issues of public policy, issues of peace and justice, issues of political orientation, issue of human sexuality, that these 18-year-olds, for all of their conscious aware lives, have only been exposed to the cable TV news shouting match as the format for debating those important issues. Because as we can all appreciate, the media generally, and certainly the cable news shows, have decided that the entertainment value of us against them, accusatory, demonizing strategy, the entertainment value of that strategy is more important than the clear and civil deliberation of intrinsically important issues. We're all complicit in that. You know, you can draw out a complicated theory about how the cable TV news stations, like the politicians themselves, are simply dishing out what we've asked for. But nonetheless, for me as someone in higher education, it's disturbing to think that one of our initial challenges for those 18-year-olds is to teach them a more civil, deliberate way to discuss matters that are intrinsically opaque. And I immediately trot out some examples. I say, when you take your Shakespeare class, you're not going to be looking for that definitive interpretation of Hamlet. You're going to learn to tolerate the ambiguity of different approaches to Hamlet and the ambiguity of different interpretations over time. Views of Hamlet change over time. When you're in biology class, you're not going to find that definitive single bottom line consensus about the relationship between natural and human-made causes of red tide. There's going to be some debate there. It's a loaded issue. You have to learn to deal with the lack of resolution in a self-confident way. When you're in political theory class, you're never quite going to sort out Hobbes versus Mill and the political alternatives represented by Hobbes versus Mill. You'll learn to deal with the complexity without any clear resolution. And most important, you'll learn to deal with the fact that the students in the class with whom you disagree are not your enemy. You don't deal with a disagreement by pointing your finger and calling them a bad name and demonizing them and making up your mind first about what you think of them and then carrying on the conversation accordingly. You can all leave at the end of the class continuing to discuss despite or in the midst of your disagreement. Well, this kind of issue connects up with a larger point of the value and role of a liberal arts education in the 21st century. Now that I am close to not retiring from higher education, but leaving the president's office, I'm in my 10th year. You can only do this sort of thing so long, and over time you become a caricature of yourself, which happens to anyone who stays at a small liberal arts college very long. Tom, I don't know if you can relate to this, but your career was at a big university, but it was mentioned I spent 15 years at Oberlin. What a wonderful place, what a rich place, what a terribly located place. west of Cleveland. But why would you ever leave Oberlin for this funny little place here? Well, I got to the 15-year mark, and I looked around at my colleagues and said, if I stay another 15 years, who would I like to be like? And the answer was really nobody. I mean, really, really nobody. And I realized that the people that hit the 30-year mark had just become a caricature of themselves. And now that I'm pushing the 20-year mark at New College, I'm realizing I need to reinvent myself if I'm to be able to get through the day without laughing too hard. But nonetheless, for the time that remains for me to be obligated to think about these overview and liberal arts vision issues, I think a lot about not just the importance of initiating 18-year-olds into the role of critical thinking in a non-accusatory manner that endorses and emphasizes toleration for various viewpoints and is driven by respect for everybody else in the room. I'm thinking not just about that, but I'm thinking about the legacy that nourishes that vision of what a sound education ought to be about, the Enlightenment legacy, the legacy we associate with the hard-to-pronounce Immanuel Kant. I just gotten done discussing how some people choose Kant over Nietzsche because it's easier to spell, and then they trip over the pronunciation. But that's the legacy, of course, of the Enlightenment. And what I want to talk about, the boring part of this is my attempt to do some historical survey about the Enlightenment legacy, 18th century European Enlightenment, of which our own revolution was in many ways a reflection. And that part of the Enlightenment that has been flat out falsified, an Enlightenment prediction that has been flat out falsified. And that's the prediction, I'll come back to this in a more detailed way, but that's the prediction that as critical thinking driven by respect for the increasing prestige of mathematics and science that characterized the 17th and 18th centuries, the kind of critical thinking coming out of that new paradigm for thought and knowledge and justification of truth claims, that will gradually move sectarian, religiously driven forms of thought to the side, and life will gradually become more cosmopolitan, and the role of religious difference, ethnic difference, racial difference will gradually decline from public life as our political and social institutions gradually become more rational in history. That's what they believed in the 18th century. Boy, were they wrong. But most of what informs our ideal of a liberal arts education also comes from what they believed. What else might they have been wrong about? Or how chastened should we feel in light of all this? Well, people like Lessing and Kant and the great French thinkers, Diderot, Voltaire, all trusted that things would become more rational over time. Maybe connected with the curious fact that unlike people in the medieval period, unlike people living in what we look back on as the Middle Ages, people in the Enlightenment were self-conscious about living in a distinctive period. They called it the Enlightenment. Alf Clarenc in Kant's case, he actually wrote an essay called What is Enlightenment? The French knew that they were living in an illuminated or enlightened age. I guarantee you Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century didn't get up in the morning and say, it's really great living in the Middle Ages. There's a different framework there. People in the 18th century, at least those of this enlightened class, really understood that they were living in a special time, a distinctive time. Kant wrote an essay, that essay, What is Enlightenment, and answered his own question by saying it means dare to know, dare to think, dare to come out from under your tutelage, tutelage there being a complicated way of referring to misplaced authority, authority placed on you in that European context by priest, clergyman, or king. In the 18th century, really was the period when that differentiation between questioning authority and accepting unquestioned authority became very clear. To be enlightened meant to question authority, and I think everybody in this room probably has a side of them that you're here partly because you're in the habit of questioning authority. It's the opposite of dogmatism. And everybody in this room can understand the issues embedded in the debate about dogmatism versus criticizing authority, questioning authority, not with a destructive view in mind, but with a view to getting to the best possible result. Well, this is an appeal to the importance of self-direction under the powers of one's own rational autonomy. Kant himself, in fact, defined freedom or autonomy, as he refined the term, as the capacity to legislate laws to oneself. That's what autonomy was for him, the capacity to legislate laws to oneself. Notice the explicit transition of the motif of legislation from an external force imposed upon the individual to myself, out of respect for myself, which was that motif of self-respect closely tied up for Kant with this notion of legislating laws to oneself. And as I try to mention, I work this in typically at the end of my remarks to new students, at the risk of really sending them screaming. You know, the last thing a new student wants to hear when they're all excited about moving into the room, meeting their roommates, getting their meal card, is to hear about a German philosopher from the 18th century. But I point out that many of them have arrived on our steps at New College because if you know much about us or read our literature, you know that there's quite an element of freedom at the college to design your own course of study. That's one of the appealing features of the place. And I usually conclude my remarks to the new students by saying, many of you came here, I'll bet, because you thought New College was a place where you can do anything you want. And I say, I have very bad news for you. There is no place in the world where you can do anything you want. And I challenge you to rethink the view of freedom that informs that notion of doing anything you want, and introduce Kant's notion of freedom as not as spontaneity, not as equivalent to being, you know, libertine, but as the capacity to legislate laws to oneself, the disciplining, refining features of that notion of autonomy. Note the motif of self-control, if you will, that's embedded in that definition of autonomy. Freedom without self-control isn't freedom at all. It's just a perpetuation of childishness. Not the same as childlikeness. Well, as we know, German thinkers who were charting these fresh waters regarding critical thinking, autonomy, questioning authority, they would go on in the next two centuries to construct more and more obscure ways in which to depict these matters, and writing books that none of us can really get through. While their peers across the border in France were setting new records for literary liveliness and provocation, interesting differences in national ethos with respect to philosophical and other writing. Diderot, for his part, his way of approaching these things instead of the drudgery of autonomy and tutelage and all those Kantian terms was to say that he won't live soundly until the last king is hanged in the entrails of the last priest. Now that gets your attention. And none of this business about Germanic drudgery. Well, the criticism of religion and religious belief, of course, was front and center in this whole legacy that gives rise to the prediction that religious differences will gradually decline in their impact and their power, that prediction that turned out to be wrong. On the one hand, for people like Kant and others, traditional religious belief would be criticized as, in effect, bad science. In other words, religious belief is increasingly thought to be intellectually disruptible and superstitious because it gets so many things wrong about how things go in the world. By inheriting the intellectual benefits of the scientific revolution of the previous century, the 17th century, progressive thinkers of the Enlightenment or the 18th century thought they could dispel, for instance, belief in miracles, make fun of belief in miracles the way Voltaire makes fun of the parting of the Red Sea, and in principle at least give a scientific rather than religious explanation of all physical events, such as the healing of a child. This replacement of religious forms of explanation and of intellectual authority, their replacement with scientific forms, is at the very center, of course, of what we mean by secularization. In contrast to Galileo's day, remember the trouble he got into by looking through his telescope, And when he invited the other priests to look through his telescope to see what he saw, they wouldn't do it. In contrast to Galileo's day, today's scientist working in a university setting does not need to ask the priest's blessing on his or her endeavors. That's not a trivial change. That's not a trivial difference. That's a pretty important difference, the switch over between religious and scientific authority. So this first sort of Enlightenment criticism of traditional religious belief argues that traditional religious belief gets things wrong regarding the physical universe and now represents an unwarranted intrusion into the secular. A diagnosis of epilepsy should not have to compete with the notion of demon possession, which is what we now think of as epilepsy. That's how it used to be understood. That's pretty interesting when you read the Gospel of Mark and the exorcisms of demons by Jesus, and to the extent that there may be a historical core to some of those narratives, maybe what he was dealing with was epileptics. And carbon-14 dating of ancient rocks cannot legitimately be challenged by Bishop Usher's belief that the world is 4,000 years old. Those exemplify the changeover in intellectual authority from religion to science. The second source of Enlightenment criticism of traditional religious belief stems from the suspicion that religious authorities exercise unwarranted social control over people, and that religion, at the end of the day, is all about social control. We can see instances of this in dramatic kinds of cases, such as women's rights or women's right to have control over her reproductive capacities, and you can go right down the line. By presuming to dictate to the consciences of the laity, the clergy rob their flock of the freedom of conscience and the right of autonomous intellectual and moral judgment. So the suspicion developed in the 18th century, it wouldn't come to full fruition systematically till the 19th century, but the suspicion grew that the imposition of prescribed religious doctrine on the laity was intended more to protect certain entrenched powers and privileges than to defend correct belief. One person I read on roughly a contemporary of Immanuel Kant's, a man named G.E. Lessing, Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, was fond of getting into religious controversy with Lutheran clergymen whom he knew he could beat up on intellectually. And one time, one of these clergy, in response, protested to the debate, not on the grounds of the issues Lessing and the clergymen were debating, but the clergyman said, by holding this debate and responding so publicly, you're upsetting the laity, you're upsetting the people. Let's do this under wraps, let's do this behind closed doors, and we can say anything we want. Well, that was very telltale with respect to the issue at hand and with respect to Lessing's sense. This whole notion that religion is really a form of social control and beliefs are not important in and of themselves so much as they're important for expressions of social control driven partly by the clergy or clergy in cahoots with secular and economic powers, that would come to full fruition in the work of Friedrich Nietzsche and his theory of resentment and his view that religious beliefs and practices and institutions are strategies by which the mediocre and the less talented gain control over the truly superior and the talented. Think about that. Well, packed into this Enlightenment dual criticism, this outlook on religion, is both a normative claim and the prediction that I'm long-windedly working up to. The normative claim is that the improvement of society depends heavily upon reducing the influence of religious belief and practice and increasing the influence of secular, particularly scientific standards of judgment and practice. Life will become better if we do that. The prediction, my topic really, the prediction or the hope is that history will in fact become increasingly secular, increasingly rational, with rationality based on the paradigm of math and science where if something mathematical is true in one place and always, it's true in another place and always, that touchstone of universality. And this will happen through the continued development of democratic institutions which allow the truth to surface and flourish. Right-minded, rational people will recognize it and vote accordingly. And this will happen as well through increasing control over nature through technological improvement and innovation. We've sort of had the technological improvement and innovation. We haven't had most of the rest. One way to get at this point is to suggest that from the mainstream Enlightenment standpoint and their 19th century successors, progress is associated with increasing cosmopolitanism. Progress is associated with increasing cosmopolitanism. Cosmopolitanism, the breaking down of national boundaries. You know, if you're cosmopolitan, you can live and speak the native languages comfortably in Paris or in Moscow or in St. Petersburg as in Sarasota or New York or Beijing. And you can travel around unhindered by national, let alone ethnic and religious and racial differences. Just as the canons of judgment associated with the natural sciences are universal in character, so the thinking goes, universal social and political ideals associated, for instance, with human rights will gradually emerge, take root, and their universal, indubitable nature will create an increasingly cosmopolitan, unified world, less fragmented by national boundaries, less affected by ethnic division, less affected by sectarian strife. The, quote, reasonability of this outlook will win out over the divisiveness of the religious outlook. Kant himself, by the way, wrote an essay with the interesting title, Idea for a Universal History from a Cosmopolitan Point of View. And that sowed the seeds for what would later become the idea of the League of Nations and the United Nations, create structures that transcended nationalistic divisions. Well, needless to say, things haven't worked out this way. The predictors of cosmopolitanism and of a progressive view of history, in most important respects, were just flat out wrong. It's interesting in the complex areas that I dig around in, having to do with modern intellectual history, the relationship between philosophy and modern Christian thought. There's so few things that can be shown to be, you know, demonstrated to be wrong on some kind of empirical basis. I have overwhelming evidence something's wrong. It's very rare that that happens. But in this case, there seems to be overwhelming empirical evidence that the Enlightenment trusts that sectarian, religiously driven divisions and strife will lose their effectiveness in time, certainly by the 20th century and, of course, by the 21st century. Remember, we ended the 20th century with terrible ethnic cleansing in the Balkans. We began the century with the Balkan problem that generated World War I. We ended the century on a note of Balkanization. Those are terrible bookends from the standpoint of the Enlightenment trust in cosmopolitanism. Today, virtually every trouble spot in the world that we read about in the morning papers, if anybody still reads the papers, or look at on our computer version of the paper on the internet, every trouble spot involves religious and ethnic divisiveness. And similarly, we see the renewed ways in which religious belief fuels political movements beginning in our own country. It's as though we've entered a new age of the Crusades in a lot of ways. I've been helped by a book by a University of Hawaii professor named Mark Juergensmeyer, named The New Cold War, Religious Nationalism Confronts the Secular State, in which he says that we end the 20th century and begin the 21st with religion more politically potent than it ever has been before. And he's trying to figure out why this is, partly in light of the failure of the Enlightenment prediction. Religion, Juergensmeyer notes, is the only thing besides nationalism that provides moral sanction to violence and martyrdom. And we need not think simply of Islamic terrorism in regard to that observation. Juergensmeyer, by his own admission, got interested in this in the wake of Jonestown and Waco. In explaining his point about this parallel between religion and nationalism as the only motivators for violence, respectable motivators for violence and martyrdom. He says, religion, like secular nationalism, is the glue that holds together broad communities. Members of these communities share a tradition. They share a particular worldview in which the essential conflict between appearance and a deeper reality is described in specific cultural terms. Notice that dualistic tendency which enfranchises us against them thinking. And you know, you don't have to be brilliant to understand that us against them is at the heart of our problem. And you know, why we can't form human life around the we're all in this together, I just don't know. But going on with Jürgenmeier's quote, this deeper reality has a degree of permanence and order quite unobtainable by other means. The conflict between the two levels of reality is what both religion and nationalism are about. The language of both contains images of grave disorder as well as of tranquil order, holding out the hope that despite appearances to the contrary, order will eventually triumph and disorder will be contained, or one might say vanquished. A great deal of literature about religion, and Professor White, who will be with you two sessions from now, is an expert in these matters. A great deal of the study of the nature of religion has to do with what's embedded in this remark, namely a functionalist view of religion, a functionalist understanding of religion. You look at a religion not with a view to are its doctrinal claims true or false, but what's its function? What does it do? What does it provide for people? And Jürgenmeier is implicitly saying religion, like nationalism, gives people a sense of meaning for life that helps them categorize what threatens or bothers or annoys or scares them and helps locate them in that arena of goodness and virtue and truth that's standing over against what threatens them and gives them a strategy for battling against the bad side and the hope, the eschatological hope, that this battle over time will be won if we stay the course. Well, what we seem to have more and more, of course, is, sadly enough, the fusion of nationalism and religion. It's like, let's take the worst of both these things and put them together and see what we have in a more powerful and combustible force. Each political and religious setting around the globe, of course, requires a separate analysis. But there are certainly functional parallels among otherwise such disparate cases as the power of the Christian religious right in this country, the dynamic we associate with Islamic fundamentalism in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East, and the political leverage enjoyed by the so-called religious parties in modern-day Israel. You can provide your own additional examples, but the general lesson is clear. The prediction of an emerging cosmopolitanism seems laughably off mark. And in these kinds of cases, religion is obviously playing a role that's utterly unaccounted for by that Enlightenment tradition's analysis of the relationship between religion and rational thinking in the modern world. I don't have a solution to this, but I have a fresh way of thinking about these matters, and it stems from my own efforts to grapple with this. You know, and yeah, my field is philosophy of religion, but I'm officially a religion professor which I make sure I don't tell the person next to me on the plane. I've learned over time that's a very dangerous thing. Although that can create some highlight moments. Back when you know people used to ask, "Well, what do you teach? Religion?" One person, one of the better moments in my professional life was when the response was, "Oh, do you know Billy Graham?" So I don't know where that came from, but I'm delighted with that. I really wished I'd handled that differently in retrospect, too. And oh, yes, a long time. But nonetheless, I have to think about the nature of religion as such, especially when you know people are interested in comparative religions. And I'm teaching a course now on faith and reason. I spoke about faith and reason here last year. I'm teaching variation on that course again. And even though it focuses on Western, especially kind of specifically Christian theological issues, students are always interested in comparative religions. They're all interested. There's always that question, aren't religious traditions all getting at the same thing in a different way? And isn't there something like the golden rule, you know, that sort of animates all religions and they're just getting it the same way? A lot of different ways of coming back at that, but that kind of issue and issues like it leave people like me needing to stay abreast of contemporary work in what we call methodology in the study of religion, including different definitions. Here's one coming from a prominent anthropologist. The anthropologist's name is Clifford Geertz, G-E-E-R-T-Z, who may be known to some of you, died just a few years ago. Listen to this, I'll read it twice. Religion is a system of symbols that acts to establish powerful, pervasive, and long-lasting moods and motivations in people, and clothes those symbols with such an aura of factuality that the moods and motivations seem uniquely realistic. There was nothing in there about the truth of a religious claim. It was all about the power. Religion and the symbolic aspect, a system of symbols that acts to establish powerful, pervasive, and long-lasting beliefs, ethics, good behavior, no, moods and motivations, and clothes those symbols with such an aura of factuality, makes them seem factual, makes them seem true. And he says this in a way that begs the question, are they or aren't they? Well, he's an anthropologist. He's just kind of approaching this from kind of an outsider standpoint. Clothes those symbols with such an aura of factuality that the moods and motivations seem uniquely realistic. More real than the other moods and motivations in that person's life, in that adherent's life. This is a potential key to what the Enlightenment thinkers and their successors have missed. They were analyzing religion in terms of its truth value, its truth claims. It's bad science, or it's primitive science. They're silly beliefs. Well, that Enlightenment approach underestimates the role of what we might call the non-rational or even the irrational elements in the religious life, moods and motivations. It took me a trial marriage before my current successful marriage to realize, don't ever, ever tell anybody how they should feel. And there's something true to that. There's true about that. People can't help how they feel. And don't pass judgment on how they feel. You might have to negotiate how the way they feel makes you feel. But don't tell them how to feel. And similarly, if the feelings, the non-rational element, the moods and motivations associated with the impact of the symbol system of religion is what's really most important to the adherent, and not the beliefs that the Enlightenment thinkers are criticizing, they were looking at the wrong thing, or their analysis was too thin. I'm not suggesting that religion in principle is non-rational or irrational as such, but I do think it's correct to say that religious belief and practice typically involve non-rational elements that strike powerful chords running through men and women. Samuel Taylor Coleridge once, who was very interested in these issues, he's very interesting on this whole topic in addition to just being a great poet, Coleridge, talking about the evidence or reasons for religious belief, once said, show a man his need of it, his want of it, and he will find his own reasons. And you have a similar motif in William James, the great American philosopher and psychologist who spoke about the will to believe. My point is neither to criticize nor to defend religion or religious belief, but simply to suggest that the Enlightenment thinkers who predicted religion's demise had not gone deep enough in their account. They hadn't gone deep enough not only into religion, but of human nature. Human nature itself was much more complex than they were allowing. We see this as well, and this is well known because of the debate about the Enlightenment legacy with respect to the issue of evil in human life. Enlightenment thinkers predominantly thought that evil was lodged in ignorance, not the will. And they carried forward the basically Platonic trust that to know the good is to do the good, and that if we improved everyone's knowledge base and approached the truth, we'd more naturally do the good thing. Kant's own countrymen disproved that in the 20th century, when at the height of their cultural and scientific and technological superiority, they devoted that to the ever-improved gas chamber, the ever-more efficient death camp. So the disjunction between scientific and technological attainment, the improvement of knowledge, and an ethical base has never been more clear. I made that point in June to the Board of Governors, to a packed house. I'm surprised that New College has any more funding anymore, because it was in the context of the Board of Governors and the Chancellor promoting as its initiative with the legislature in order to enhance funding for the universities generally, the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. Certainly a good idea, and it's in the context of encouraging the legislature to see that we need to shift Florida's economic base away from tourism and growth and agriculture and towards a knowledge-based economy, which would be driven by the universities, thus justifying an enhancement of funding for the universities, especially in science, technology, engineering, and math. And I made the same point in that setting about how those who designed the Nazi death camp sure knew a lot about science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In that context, I was making a pitch for the liberal arts and an educated citizenry, because the political superstructure in this state, I'm sad to say, you know, lovely people, nice people, but the political superstructure enhancing higher education is so driven by the notion of economic development and critical needs occupations, and let's get degrees in people's hands who can then use those degrees to go right out into the workplace. All critically important. But nobody's talking about education. Nobody's talking about the connection between the capacity to deal with ambiguity and complexity in a calm, confident way, and the improvement of the society. And it's hard to get that. You know, Florida doesn't have a tradition of liberal arts colleges. I mean, it's not like being in the Northeast. We were just talking before. If you're in the New England states or Pennsylvania or the upper Midwest, everybody knows what liberal arts colleges. Here, when I'm lobbying in Tallahassee, I've been told, don't use the word liberal. That will just throw them off. This is absolutely true. In fact, after my first year of being president, at the end of 2001, 2002, and had a very astute lobbyist who took me aside and said, can I give you some advice? And I said, of course. And she said, don't use the word liberal and stop wearing button-down shirts. So that was an interesting little juxtaposition. Well, in any case, the general point here, and I'll come close to concluding so we can have some discussion. The identification of scientific sophistication and high culture, the identification of scientific sophistication, the very ideal of the Enlightenment and high culture, the identification of that with virtue turned out to be wrong, just as the prediction of an increasingly cosmopolitan world turned out to be wrong. So as I said at the outset, this set of issues gets me to thinking, what else was the Enlightenment heritage which we rely on heavily for the ideal of a liberal arts education? What else might it have been wrong about? I guess let me conclude by saying I just want to kind of emphasize the possibility that the function of religious belief perhaps supersedes in importance the believability of religious beliefs. We maybe want to shift from the question, is a particular religious belief true, and focus more on the question, what role does a given religious belief or set of beliefs play in the lives of the believers? And we do this having come off of a century that set new records for, kind of ironically, 20th century that is, set new records for the appeal of non-rational expressions of human endeavor. There's a complicated story to tell here, because I think most of this could be explained by World War I. And I think 9/11 in our century may, in retrospect, wind up playing the same role for this century that World War I played in the way the 20th century unfolded. But the 20th century was the century of the rise and influence of psychoanalysis, which says that the conscious side of us is not in control, which raises serious questions about freedom. It's unconscious forces that are playing themselves out. It is the era of existentialism, which posits a radically, absolutely free will with no stable metaphysical background. Let's go. We can't. Why not? We're waiting for Godot. And Godot never comes. What's that about? Even when I brew a cup of tea, I change the world, says Sartre. But he doesn't know what to do with that. It is the era of surrealism and other forms of artistic expression, such as Dadaism, which intentionally put in question the rational ordering and patterning of the objects of everyday experience. So you see them in fresh juxtapositions in ways that make them strange. And of course, most troublingly, with respect to the 20th century, is the era of fascism in the political arena, which appeals to irrational reservoirs of racism, motifs of power and nationalism to generate political activity. Religion has been complicit in much of this, and we begin this century, or we are now a decade into this century, which I think challenges us to think in fresh ways about the role of religion in the modern world, and not just wish that nutty right-wing Christians will kind of go away and stop trying to assume ownership of the political process, but deal with the fact that there's something powerful and important and long-lasting going on there, that one of a more progressive sensibility cannot ignore. So there's a lot more to be said on all this, but let me just sort of stop and see what kind of reaction or you know, I don't know if fruit was handed around to throw at the speaker, but see if that happens. That's sometimes my experience.
Thank you very much, Mike. We're going to pass the microphones around. Would you please state your name before you ask a question, and Don will take questions on that side, and I'll take them over here.
And we will do every other side.
Who wants to go first?
Okay.
Can you press anything?
Oh. Hello? Is it on?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Les Downing. I'm a retired social psychology professor from the SUNY system up north. And for years, I taught a course of my own making called Belief and Commitment in Groups, sometimes called In Cults and Other Powerful Groups. And the emphasis was on cults. And I developed a lot of stuff along these lines. The more I studied it, the more I became convinced that what people believe is less and less related to any of the logical, rational kinds of things which the Enlightenment thought it would be, and is more and more related to things like social factors, social support, belongingness, identification, and so forth. And in studying cults, it's clearly the case that the fact that the belief system is totally irrational or even insane from our point of view does not deter people from believing in it. I was very much interested all along and started off really trying to figure out how in Jonestown the followers of Jim Jones could continue to believe in him as a messenger of God. Some of them thought of him as God himself, to the point where they were willing to murder their own children in order to follow his directives. The relationship between logic and belief and commitment to those beliefs is very strange, I think, at least from an Enlightenment point of view. And I'm not optimistic, as you, and I sort of agree with you about this disconnect that occurs. But there's a question for you, is that it seems like there's not a, this is not a homogeneous kind of an effect. Around the world, this is treated in somewhat different ways, that especially in Scandinavian countries and in Western Europe, religion has become less and less a part or a dominant part of the way people make their decisions and lead their lives. This is where this Enlightenment started, in Western Europe, and in those countries, religion has become less and less important. And I wondered if you would like to comment on how Western Europe is different from the United States with respect to these kinds of issues.
One obvious thing to say, beginning with the, first of all, everything you covered is pretty provocative and good to know about your experience. There's this paradox that the European countries, really beginning with the Scandinavian countries that have the lowest level of real belief and certainly lowest, by far the lowest level of attendance at worship, still have state religions. And we theoretically, at least, have separation of church and state, and by global standards, a very high rate of attendance at religious worship. But, you know, people are always seeking fresh ways to structure and understand their ethical commitments. And for me, one of the most fascinating features of our landscape in the last 20, 30 years, and Professor White, who's coming two speakers from now, is an expert on this, is the increasingly large people who don't self-identify as being members of a particular religion, but do identify themselves as spiritual. And that reflects something important, it seems to me, that the structured institutions have lost their capacity to meet a need, but the need hasn't gone away. And most people still take ethical obligation very seriously. Most people want to lead a good life. They not only want to have a good life, they want to lead a good life. There's a lot of challenge to doing that, especially for people who associate traditional religion with a lot of things that are wrong. Complicated. The Roman Catholic case is just so powerfully poignant and tragic and awful. I jokingly tell my Roman Catholic friends to whom I'm close enough to tell this joke, I said, if the Roman Catholic Church had any sense of decency, it would put a moratorium on all moral pronouncements for the next 50 years. Which actually I believe, but it's not for me to say, and I sort of use it to provoke my Roman Catholic friends. And that almost always elicits story after story, compelling and true, about a priest here, a priest there, a priest there, a nun here, nun here, nun there, who are just doing wonderful, wonderful self-sacrificing work. And the big tragedy next to the tragedy affecting the children who've been sexually assaulted, the big tragedy is that everybody's been cast under the shadow, including all of those. And in some ways, that's a kind of a dramatic, exaggerated version of what we have to keep in mind. You know, whatever negative things you can say about the non-rational side of religious belief and the negative implications for political and civil arrangements very often from religious belief, there's decency in there too, and how you sort that out is tricky.